This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of January 5th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 377, and Happy New Year! The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest, I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker, and on the Big Deal feature, it's the first edition of 2025, a time when people resolve to drink less and exercise more. My guest is West Vancouver columnist Kirk Lapointe. His first column of the new year for Business in Vancouver in Glacier Media is a must-read. Improving democracy should be a New Year's resolution for us all. Hear about his five-point plan. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. It's the first podcast of 2025, and of course, every new year, people are making resolutions right, left, and center to eat or drink less and exercise more. Well, politicians in power at various levels of government, they've also made resolutions. They've resolved to cut back on citizen engagement. They've found ways around citizen involvement. They've found ways to keep more secrets. They conveniently forget that it's the public that owns public institutions. The public is the boss. The ideal person to discuss this, Kirk Lapointe, veteran reporter and editor and runner-up for the Vancouver Mayoralty in 2014. His first column of 2025 for Business in Vancouver and Glacier Media papers and websites is headlined, "Improving Democracy Should Be a New Year's Resolution for Us All." Kirk says that low voter turnout, disengaged youth, and dysfunctional legislatures are all demanding action, and he has a five-point plan to turn it all around. First off, you say that we should make voting mandatory. We're going to have a federal election this year. It won't be mandatory, but if you had the chance, had the power, you would make voting mandatory for elections here in Canada. Why?
Well, first of all, it works in other countries. There's at least a half dozen other countries, other democracies, that have long since instituted mandatory voting. And the reason being that it just compels a lot more engagement among the voting public. It helps in a lot of ways raise the turnout overall. And I think in the end, what we're really getting from it is a stronger will of the people when they go to vote. There should be, in a lot of ways, engagement that compels people to participate in their political institutions. And I think in watching this and seeing where it's worked in other countries, what it has done, you know, most certainly is that it's elevated the turnout rate, which, as you know, has flagged in recent decades. We now have, you know, federal level turnouts of about 60%, at provincial levels a little more than 50%, at municipal levels in some cases 30 to 40%. So we have to do something in order to incentivize people to vote, or to disincentivize people for not voting. So that's kind of where I started on that one. But, you know, in the absence of having the mandatory vote, there are other things we can do around tweaking the voting system.
Yeah, if not mandatory voting, what about adding a box, a none of the above box, to the ballots? That if citizens are not enthused by any of the alternatives that they're offered on the ballot, what about a box that just says none of the above? And if there's enough people voting none of the above, then have another election.
I think it's that's a fair point. I think that what we need, though, is to bring people out to the voting stations on election day or in the run-up to the election through advanced voting. I think that what we need here is a clearer signal that we want people to engage in the political situation, and we want them to turn out to vote. And that means, in a lot of ways, preparing yourself, understanding the issues, looking at the candidates, and determining that, you know, you're going to go and put your X beside the name, or in some cases say, you know, or disqualify yourself or spoil your ballot as a statement that you're not voting for anybody that's up for it in your riding.
And you also suggest that we should lower the voting age. I mean, there's 16-year-olds today will be the 20-year-olds after the end of the term in 4 years. 16-year-olds today are able to get a driver's license. You know, why can't they put an X in a box in a ballot for a candidate in the election?
Well, even 16 is a little bit old in some cases, because you have 13 and 14-year-olds and 12-year-olds, in fact, who can belong to the New Democratic Party. You have 13 and 14-year-olds that can elect the leader of the Liberals or the leader of the federal Conservatives. So, you know, we've let young people into the political process long ago. And now we're faced with the idea of formal voting ages of 16. At the same time, you know, you have a driver's license. You can be taxed. You can work in a restaurant to prepare a meal for people. All sorts of things are conferred on a 16-year-old. So what I ask is, why not the vote? This kind of snide remark that I hear from a lot of adults is that, you know, young people age 16 don't have critical thinking faculties, aren't susceptible to all sorts of other forms of information or influence to kind of take them away from believing that they actually have the right to do this. I just think long ago, a 16-year-old of today is very different than a 16-year-old when I grew up, when I was 16. I think that there ought to be a mechanism to lower that rate, lower the age of voting, and I really don't see the consequences of it that others do. The difference between 16 and 18 in terms of brain science is quite different than, say, the 9 to 12-year-olds who now walk around with phones. I mean, we're allowing all sorts of young people to do all sorts of things, and we allow them to drive, we allow them to work, and we tax them as a result, but they can't vote. And in a lot of cases, I think what it has done is created a bit of a lack of integrity in the overall system, because in some cases, young people can vote, and a lot of issues that would be very germane to them, they can't capture them with any kind of a vote. They have to be 18 in order to do it.
It would create a new target market for politicians, and of course, a new cohort of voters, numbers that could sway an election one way or another. But do you think that if that was to happen, to lower the voting age, that there should be other mechanisms that should be activated, such as improving civics education, for instance, improving media education, just so that those younger voters would be able to develop a BS meter earlier on?
In other countries, that's exactly what has happened. It becomes much more ingrained. Civic education becomes ingrained in the curriculum. It's you are being given different life skills that then help you understand and then contribute to the fact that you can vote at age 16. Historically, it's interesting that you get the first time that you do vote at age 18 and up. You then go into colleges or post-secondary institution, and that's when you have actually a kind of a strange drop-off. It's that at that point, until people get back into their communities, anchor themselves with careers, perhaps start families, that they don't come back in with a very clear consistency around exercising the vote. So in a lot of ways, this starts that trend a lot sooner. It creates behavioral habits that basically persist into their 20s and 30s and 40s. So again, the presence of a vote at age 16 in a lot of countries has has really resulted in lifelong voting habits. And at 18, when people are generally jumping into post-secondary education, where they then come out the other side of it, where they're not voting as intensely, you know, you end up with a bit of a misshapen contour around those that vote and those that don't. And of course, politicians know extremely well, and they tailor their policies, they tailor their messages toward those who are usually around 40 and older. They see the numbers. They see that young people don't vote in great numbers, and that there aren't great numbers of them that would sway certain types of issues. And so they pander to that. They even create laws and regulations that basically are, you know, that skew older. So by lowering the vote, essentially, it's also a signal to the political class that it has to take the youth cohort much more seriously.
Now, you also suggest turning question period into answer period. Question period, of course, is the time in the legislature in Victoria, in House of Commons in Ottawa, where the opposition politicians, opposition leader mostly, gets to ask questions of the government leader or cabinet ministers about their portfolios, about mistakes that have been made, about concerns of constituents, about issues that are in the media. And the those of us in the media, we set our clocks to it. The public, maybe not so much, but it's often great theater, but we often don't get answers. And you suggest that we should turn question period into answer period.
Yeah, very much so. Look, I think that the turning point for all of this was when television came to the House of Commons, and that was back in the 1970s. At that point, people became much more performative, both opposition MPs who would theatrically create their statements and then questions. And of course, the government of the day would in a lot of cases also have much better rehearsed talking points, and in some cases, much more evasive approaches so as not to embarrass themselves on live television. And I don't think we can roll that clock back. What we can though have is a stronger speaker in the middle of all of this. In a couple of countries, Scotland and New Zealand to some extent, the speaker is a much more active participant in question period and will often create more of a pressure on a government a minister to answer the question that's proposed, as opposed to putting another talking point up that has little or nothing to do with what that question was. In other countries, there are themed question periods, or question times as they call them, where for the entire hour or 45 minutes, however long your question period is, you're talking about, say, national defense, or you're talking about the economy that day, or you're talking about healthcare that day. And what that does is it essentially puts the minister involved into a situation where she or he has to dive more deeply into policy, into reasoning, and behind certain issues. And it focuses the opposition to frame its questioning around those issues. And what you get is, I think, a far more effective, informative question period. What it takes away, though, is some of the theatrics. So you really do get much more of a decent, a near debate about the ideas that each political party has about a certain themed issues. To me, it would be far more effective, but certainly empowering the speaker to not just be this benign, impartial person, but to basically have the speaker enforce a question with a minister in order to produce something that approaches a true answer to the question.
Now, your list of five big ideas to resolve to make Canada, BC, Vancouver, and other places more democratic in 2025 doesn't include proportional representation, but it does include the idea to create municipal wards. You think the time is now to bring back wards?
Well, look, Vancouver, let's talk about Vancouver for a second. Vancouver is deemed to have roughly two dozen distinct neighborhoods. And yet the 10 councillors for Vancouver could all live in the same apartment building and all get elected. Look, to some degree, these responses of moving to an at-large system had a lot to do with economics. It is cheaper to not have essentially small bureaucracies built around each alder person, as they're called in a lot of municipalities, or each ward representative. You almost have to create these miniaturized departments of neighborhoods with each of the people who are elected in the wards. And it's also, of course, very susceptible, depending on how you outline these wards. It can lead to a lot of income disparity among the wards themselves. So that, in a lot of ways, the design of the wards has to find ways to somehow reflect better around differing income levels and education levels and occupations that you would have, so that it doesn't end up being a rich ward and a poor ward. The devil's in the details about this one, but I do think that what we've got now is there are neighborhoods in Vancouver alone which have almost a non-existent relationship to City Hall. They don't elect any sort of a councillor out of their midst. And of course, we allow councillors and mayors, for that matter, to live outside of the entire city, and represent as a councillor. We have a party system, of course, in Vancouver, which I, even though I ran for one in 2014, I really don't think it's generally a positive thing. I think it would be better off to not have parties, but we would definitely be better off with wards. And in some cases, I know that as political parties have examined a ward structure, they also take a look at what the voting patterns are for their own party. And in some cases, like the NPA, which used to be an extremely strong party in the city, isn't anymore, they would basically identify the fact that there was kind of a ring around Vancouver and its outskirts, which would have really not worked for them. That their basic strength would come from certain parts of the city. That's where they had strong voting sentiment, and so they're not going to essentially hurt themselves by instituting a ward system. So in a lot of ways, you've got ingrained political patterns for certain parties, and it would be exactly the wrong thing for their own survival to institute a ward system. But I think we have to get past this. I think that there's an underrepresentation of a lot of neighborhoods in some of our larger cities, not just in Vancouver. I know that in Victoria, there's still a really good debate that goes on there as well. And I would imagine Surrey would be the same. Surrey hasn't tried the ward system before, but it's now, of course, the second largest and will eventually be the largest of our cities in British Columbia. It's not for every community, however. There are certain sized communities where an at-large system would probably be just fine. But I think now the complexity of some of our cities, the issues they have to deal with, and the challenges that they have, particularly in things like inequity, are really important issues to confront, and I think can be confronted best with a ward system. An at-large system, in a lot of ways, does not help those who are already disadvantaged.
And last but not least, improving the Freedom of Information Law. That is another way to make us more democratic in 2025. We've got to remind the politicians that government records are public records, that citizens own them, Politicians do not own them. Citizens own them. It's easier said than done because, as you identify there, politicians in opposition say one thing. They say they want sunshine, but when they get into office, it's different. It's often darkness. How do we change this?
Boy, it's a tough one. I mean, you know this area better than I do. I mean, I've filed thousands of these requests over four decades, but I've watched this system that I think we started it with good faith in the early 1980s, eventually lose it any kind of steam. And now I think it's really one of the least effective forms of freedom of information we have in Canada and the world. And we lost the momentum on this because very quickly politicians and the bureaucrats saw that it was going to mean that they would have to admit mistakes. They would have to acknowledge that some programs weren't value for money, that they had missed their mandate, and that they were also in a lot of ways evaluating things that and proposing them that didn't have any reason behind them, were not really effective. And there are very few political figures I've met over the years who are prepared to acknowledge mistakes, and yet everybody makes mistakes. Everybody makes mistakes, and we make mistakes in journalism. There are mistakes made in business. There are certainly mistakes made in politics. And yet a law that basically would give the public general insight into the goings on, the operations of ministries and departments, it is really quite opaque, difficult to use, sometimes quite costly to use, certainly slow to use, and to me, maybe I'm naive about this, but I would think that if you could change the culture so that actually it's normal to also strike out once in a while when you propose an idea, to not have everything work brilliantly, because that's not how life goes. If we would just get past this effort to pretend that political figures are infallible, I mean, even the Pope has given up on that. But we still hold to this idea that, governments cannot admit that they made a mistake. It's treated as an absolute weakness, as opposed to, the effect of expressing vulnerability, or in some cases, acknowledging that a mistake was made, and talking about how you learn from it and what you're going to do next time to mitigate the risk or to ensure that something doesn't happen again, to me is a value, a virtue. And politicians feel that way and will say that in opposition that they're going to go there, that, you just watch, I'm going to do this. And they get right away, they get trapped by bureaucracy and by their fellow politicians, who become defensive minded. And unfortunately, the laws are at the moment framed in such a way as to protect government information from disclosure. It's really rare that you get serious understanding of policy through freedom of information law. What you get sometimes, and you and I have both gotten them over the years, is you get something that's a little bit of a gotcha thing. We found this overspend in some budget, some office that spent too much on a trip, or indulged too much at a conference or something like that. And yet that's such tiny stuff in the course of a government's operations. And, we are, as journalists in particular, we're often shoved into finding those niggling expense issues. And it's only because we can't get at the bigger picture around how policy is created, how it's shaped with debate inside a government, how external factors help government shape, it for good and bad, certain policies. We don't have access to that. I mean, the laws keep you so far away from that. The only counter I've found over the years is in Hamburg, Germany, which is a city state effectively. And it had these large overruns on this beautiful concert hall, something that went from something like 300 million euros to well over a million euros. 100 million euros, sorry, 300 to 100 million. And as a result, the place reformed its freedom of information law that put the onus on government to argue why you should not have access to information, you should have full access to information, and you need to argue on why you would battle it. And again, what you get from that is a situation in which, you flip the script on this one. It's a bit of a judo move, if you want to call it that. And it basically compels the government to explain why it can't release certain information. And that, that the default position is that you're going to get it, and you will have to argue to not release it. It's a very different approach than what we've got now, which is that you just can't get at it. The default position in Hamburg is you get everything. And we will have to argue as a government on what it is that we wish not to release. And what it's done over the course of a decade is, again, it's turned people in government into a position where they know that they have to routinely disclose things now, and it's changed the culture there, and it's led to a more open society, and I would argue greater trust publicly in government institutions.
On that note, Vancouver has a perfect storm of skyrocketing costs at performance venues such as the Vancouver Art Gallery, which is in limbo, the Peony Amphitheater, which has doubled in cost, and then there is renovations at BC Place Stadium underway for the 2026 FIFA World Cup. I'm resolving in 2025 to keep an eye on those projects, so keep on reading thebreaker.news and listening to the podcast. And thank you to my guest, Kirk Lapointe. His column, Improving Democracy Should Be a New Year's Resolution for Us All, appears in Business in Vancouver and Glacier Media Outlets. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In Focus, Taiwan.tw, government to seek court order to disband pro-unification party. The Ministry of the Interior claimed the Chinese Unification Promotion Party is known to be involved in organized crime and has core members who have repeatedly violated the National Security Act, Anti-Infiltration Act, Cross-Strait Act, and election laws, thus endangering national security, social stability, and fair elections. Taiwan's constitution allows authorities to seek dissolution of a political party if its goals endanger the Republic of China or its democratic order. In the New Zealand Herald, multi-million-dollar meth busts in first 2 days of 2025. Customs arrests three at Auckland Airport. More than $10 million worth of methamphetamine has been seized in the first 2 days of the year after three people allegedly tried smuggling it through the border. In one incident, meth had been soaked into clothing to conceal it. Two men, a 33-year-old and a 39-year-old, arrived in the country on a flight from Toronto on New Year's Day. In the Honolulu Star Advertiser, three women dead, over two dozen people wounded in Aliamanu fireworks explosion. Police recovered tens of thousands of dollars worth of illegal fireworks from the home. A fireworks cake containing 50 or so individual cartridges of aerial fireworks was lit and tipped over, shooting sparks and other pyrotechnic material into the carport and setting off the cache of fireworks. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In Willamette Week, the founder of the North American Bigfoot Center urges caution when going into the woods in winter. Two Portland men were found dead in the Gifford Pinchot National Forest after going Bigfoot hunting on Christmas Eve. Cliff Barackman has hosted the Animal Planet show Finding Bigfoot and founded the North American Bigfoot Center in Boring in 2019. He recommends basic preparedness like backpacking and survival supplies. In Crosscut, Washington State Parks set 12 free parking days for 2025. Free days include Juneteenth, Veterans Day, World Mental Health Day, and the birthday of Nisqually's Billy Frank Jr., the late former chair of the Northwest Indian Fisheries Commission, who fought for Native treaty rights during the fish wars. And check out thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com for the stories behind these headlines. EBNDP to end lengthy 278-day break when legislature reopens February 18th, and analysis, could 2026 World Cup co-host Canada and Mexico leverage the tournament against Trump's tariffs? Read the stories behind these headlines. Go to thebreaker.news and bobmackin.substack.com.
That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. It don't matter what color you are, 'cause love will conquer. Virtual Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to people making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the folks at the University of Victoria's Canadian Institute for Substance Abuse Research. They've launched a website, the noalcohol.ca website. That's K-N-O-W, alcohol.ca. If you're on the fence about dry January, this website will help you gauge the health costs of drinking too much and the benefits of cutting back. And you can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob at thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast, the first podcast of 2025 for the week of January 5th, 2025. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on the 5th of January in 1972, President Richard Nixon announced the Space Shuttle program? Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob at thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. And introducing bobmackin.substack.com. Visit me there too. And sign up for the free email newsletter and get updates to your inbox, or follow the Breaker News for news as it happens on X, formerly Twitter. And you can support the Breaker for as little as $7 a month. For more information, go to bobmackin.substack.com. That's bobmackin.substack.com.
Until next week.